Chapter 4. The fever chart over the bed was new and clean. Only the name was on it. Lucienne Martinet, Butte-Chaumont, Rue Clavel. The girl's face on the pillow was grey. She had been operated on the night before. Ravitch carefully listened to her heart. Then he straightened up. "Better," he said. "The blood transfusion worked a minor miracle. If she lasts one more day, she has a chance." "Fine," Weber said. "Congratulations. It didn't look as if she had. A pulse of 140 and a blood pressure of 80. Caffeine, coramine, that was damn close." Ravitch shrugged his shoulders. "That's nothing to be congratulated for. She came earlier than the other girl, the one with the gold chain around her ankle. That was all." He covered the girl up. "This is the second case within a week. If it goes on, you'll have a hospital for mishandled abortions from the Butte-Chaumont. Wasn't the other girl from there, too?" Weber nodded. "Yes, and from the Rue Clavel. They probably knew each other and went to the same midwife. She even came about the same time in the evening as the other girl. It's a good thing I was able to get hold of you at the hotel. I was afraid you wouldn't be in." Ravitch looked at him. "When one lives in a hotel, one usually isn't in at night, Weber. Hotel rooms in November aren't particularly cheerful." "I can imagine that. But then why do you go on living in a hotel?" "It's a comfortable and impersonal way of living. One's alone and one isn't alone."
"Is that what you want?"
"Yes."
"You could have all that in another way, too. If you'd rent a small apartment, it would be just the same."
"Maybe." Ravitch bent over the girl again.
"Don't you think so, too, Eugenie?"
Weber asked. The nurse glanced up.
"Mr. Ravitch will never do it," she said coldly.
"Dr. Ravitch, Eugenie," Weber corrected. "I've told you 100 times. He was chief surgeon in a great hospital in Germany, far more important than I am."
"Here," the nurse began, and straightened her glasses.
Weber quickly stopped her. "All right, all right, we know all that. This country doesn't recognize foreign degrees, idiotic at that. But what makes you so sure he won't take an apartment?"
"Mr. Ravitch is a lost man. He will never build a home for himself."
"What?" Weber asked in astonishment. "What's that you are saying?"
"There is no longer anything sacred to Mr. Ravitch. That's the reason."
"Bravo," Ravitch said from the girl's bedside.
"I've never heard anything like it."
Weber stared at Eugenie.
"Why don't you ask him yourself, Dr. Weber?"
Ravitch smiled. "You hit the mark, Eugenie. But when there is no longer anything sacred to one, everything again becomes sacred in a more human way. One reveres the spark of life that pulses even in an earthworm and that forces it from time to time up to the light of day. That's not meant to be a comparison."
"You can't insult me. You have no faith."
Eugenie energetically smoothed her white coat over her breast.
"Thank God I have my faith."
Ravitch straightened up. "Faith can easily make one fanatical. That's why all religions have cost so much blood." He grinned.
"Tolerance is the daughter of doubt, Eugenie.
That explains why you, with all your faith, are so much more aggressive toward me than I, lost infidel, am toward you." Weber guffawed. "There you are, Eugenie. Don't answer. You'll get in even deeper."
"My dignity as a woman—"
"Fine," Weber interrupted. "Stick to that. That's always good. I've got to leave now. I've still some things to do in the office. Come, Ravitch. Good morning, Eugenie."
"Good morning, Dr. Weber."
"Good morning, Nurse Eugenie," Ravitch said.
"Good morning,"
Eugenie replied with an effort, and only after Weber had turned around to look at her. Weber's office was crowded with Empire furniture, white and gold and fragile. Photographs of his house and garden hung on the wall above his desk. A modern, broad chaise longue stood against the wall. Weber slept on it when he stayed overnight. The private hospital belonged to him. "What would you like to drink, Ravitch? Cognac or Dubonnet? Coffee, if there is any left."
"Of course."
Weber placed the coffee pot on the desk and put the plug in. Then he turned to Ravitch. Can you substitute for me in the Osiris this afternoon?
Of course.
You don't mind?
Well, not in the least. I've no other plans.
Fine. Then I won't have to drive in again just to go there. I can work in my garden. I'd have asked Fauchon, but he is on his vacation.
Nonsense, Ravitch said. I've done it often enough.
That's right. Nevertheless
no longer exists nowadays. Not for me.
Yes. It's idiotic enough that you are not permitted to work here officially and have to hide out as a ghost surgeon.
Oh, but Weber, that's an old story now. It is happening to all physicians who fled from Germany.
Just the same, it's ridiculous. You perform Durand's most difficult operations and he makes a name for himself.
Better than if he did them himself.
Weber laughed. I'm a fine one to talk. You do mine, too. But after all, I am a gynecologist and not a specialist in surgery.
The coffee pot began to hum. Weber turned it off. He took cups out of a closet and poured the coffee.
One thing I really don't understand, Ravitch, he said. Why do you go on living in that depressing hole, the International? Why don't you rent one of those nice new apartments in the neighborhood of the Bois? You could buy some furniture anywhere cheap. Then at least you'd know what's your own.
Yes, Ravitch said. Then I would know what was my own.
See? Why don't you do it?
Ravitch took a gulp of his coffee. It was bitter and very strong.
Weber, he said, you are a magnificent example of the convenient thinking of our time. In one breath you are sorry because I work illegally here, and at the same time you ask me why I don't rent a nice apartment.
What's one got to do with the other?
Ravitch smiled patiently. If I take an apartment, I must be registered with the police. I would need a passport and a visa for that.
Well, that's right. I hadn't thought of that.
And in hotels, you don't need any?
Well, there too. But, thank God, there are a few hotels in Paris that don't take registration too seriously.
Ravitch poured a few drops of cognac into his coffee.
One of them is the International. That's why I live there. I don't know how the landlady arranges it, but she must have good connections. Either the police really don't know about it, or they are bribed. At any rate, I have lived there for quite a long time, undisturbed.
Weber leaned back.
Ravitch, he said. I didn't know that. I only thought you weren't permitted to work here. That's a hell of a situation.
It's paradise, compared with a German concentration camp.
And the police? If they do come some day?
If they catch us, we get a few weeks' imprisonment and are deported across the border, mostly into Switzerland. In case of a second offence, we get 6 months in prison.
What?
6 months, Ravitch said.
Weber stared at him.
But that's impossible. That's inhuman.
That's what I thought, too, until I experienced it.
How do you mean, experienced?
Has that ever happened to you?
Not once, 3 times. Just as to hundreds of others as well. In the beginning, when I knew nothing about it and counted on so-called humaneness. After that I went to Spain, where I didn't need any passport, and got a second lesson in applied humaneness from German and Italian flyers. Then later, when I returned to France, I, of course, knew the ins and outs of it.
Weber got up.
But for heaven's sake, he figured it out. Then you have been imprisoned over a year for nothing?
Well, not as long as that. Only 2 months.
Well, how is that? Didn't you say in the case of a second offence it was 6 months?
Ravitch smiled.
There are no second offences when one is experienced. One is deported under one name and simply returns under another, if possible, at another point on the frontier. That's how we avoid it. Since we have no papers, it can only be proven if someone recognizes us personally. That very rarely happens.
Ravitch is my third name. I've used it for almost 2 years. Nothing has happened in that time. It seems to have brought me luck. I'm beginning to like it more every day. By now I've almost forgotten my real name.
Weber shook his head.
And all this simply because you are not a Nazi?
Naturally. Nazis have first-class papers and all the visas they want.
Nice world we live in, and the government doesn't do a thing.
There are several million men out of work for whom the government has to care first. Besides, it's not only in France. The same thing is happening everywhere. Ravitch got up. Adieu, Weber. I'll look in on the girl again in 2 hours, and once more at night.
Weber followed him to the door.
Listen, Ravitch, he said. Why don't you come out to our house sometime, for dinner?
Certainly.
Ravitch knew he would not go.
Sometime soon.
Adieu, Weber.
Adieu, Ravitch. And do come, really.
Ravitch went into the nearest bistro. He sat by a window so that he could look out upon the street. He loved that, to sit without thinking and watch the people passing by. Paris was the city where one could best spend one's time doing nothing. The waiter wiped the table and waited.
A Pernod, Ravitch said.
With water, sir?
No, Ravitch deliberated. Don't bring me a Pernod.
There was something he had to wash away, a bitter taste. For that, the sweet anise wasn't sharp enough.
Bring me a Calvados, he said to the waiter, a double Calvados.
Very well, sir.
It was Weber's invitation, that tinge of pity in it, to grant someone an evening with a family. The French rarely invite foreigners to their homes. They prefer to take them to restaurants. He had not yet been to Weber's. It was well meant, but hard to bear. One could defend oneself against insults, not against pity. He took a gulp of the apple brandy. Why did he have to explain to Weber his reasons for living in the International? It wasn't necessary. Weber had known all he need know. He knew that Ravitch was not permitted to operate. That was enough. That he worked with him nevertheless was his affair. In this way he made money and could arrange for operations he did not dare perform himself. No one knew about it, only he and the nurse, and she kept quiet. It was the same with Durand. Whenever he had an operation to perform, he stayed with the patient until he went under the anaesthetic. Then Ravitch came and performed the operation for which Durand was too old and incompetent. When the patient awoke later on, there was Durand, the proud surgeon, at his bedside. Ravitch saw only the covered patient. He knew only the narrow iodine-stained area of the body bared for the operation. He very often did not know even on whom he operated. Durand gave him the diagnosis, and he began to cut. Durand paid Ravitch about one-tenth of what he received for an operation. Ravitch didn't mind. It was better than not operating at all. With Weber, he worked on a more friendly basis. Weber paid him a quarter of the proceeds. That was fair. Ravitch looked through the window. And what besides? There wasn't much else left. But he was alive. That was enough. At a time when everything was tottering, he had no wish to build up something that was bound shortly to fall into ruins. It was better to drift than to waste energy. That was the one thing that was irreplaceable. To survive meant everything, until somewhere a goal again became visible. The less energy that took, the better. Then one would have it afterwards. The ant-like attempt to build up a bourgeois life again and again in a century that was falling to pieces, he had seen that ruin many. It was touching, ridiculous, and heroic at the same time, and useless. It made one weary. An avalanche couldn't be stopped once it had started to move. Whoever tried fell beneath it. Better to wait, and later to dig out the victims. On long marches one had to travel light, also when one was fleeing. Ravitch looked at his watch. It was time to look at Lucien Martinet, and then go to the Osiris. The whores in the Osiris were waiting. Although they were examined regularly by an official physician, the Madame was not content with that. She could not afford to have anyone contract a disease in her place. For that reason, she had made an arrangement with Weber to have the girls privately re-examined each Thursday. Sometimes Ravitch substituted for him. The Madame had furnished and equipped a place on the first floor as an examination room. She was proud of the fact that for more than a year none of her customers had caught anything in her establishment. But in spite of all the girls' precautions, 17 cases of venereal disease had been caused by customers.
Roland, the gouvernante, brought Ravitch a bottle of brandy and a glass.
"I think Martha has got something," she said.
"All right. I'll examine her carefully."
"I haven't let her work since yesterday. Naturally, she denies it."
"All right, Roland."
The girls came in their slips, one after the other. Ravitch knew almost all of them. Only two were new.
"You don't have to examine me, Doctor," said Léonie, a red-haired Gascon.
"Why not?"
"No clients the whole week."
"What does Madame say to that?"
"Oh, nothing. I made them order a lot of champagne. 7-8 bottles a night. 3 businessmen from Toulouse. Married. All 3 of them would have liked to, but none of them dared because of the others. Each was afraid if he came with me the others would talk about it at home. That's why they drank. Each thought he would outlast the others."
Léonie laughed and scratched herself lazily.
"The one who didn't pass out wasn't able to stand up."
"All right. Nevertheless, I've got to examine you."
"It's all right with me. Have you a cigarette, Doctor?"
"Yes, here."
Ravitch took a swab and coloured it. Then he pushed the glass slide under the microscope.
"You know what I don't understand?"
Léonie said, watching him.
"What?"
"That you still feel like sleeping with a woman when you do these things."
"I don't understand it either. You're all right. Now who's next?"
"Marthe."
Marthe was pale, slender, and blonde. She had the face of a Botticelli angel, but she spoke the argot of the Rue Blondel.
"There is nothing wrong with me, Doctor."
"That's fine. Let's have a look at you."
"But there is really nothing wrong."
"All the better."
Suddenly Roland was standing in the room. She looked at Martha. The girl stopped talking. She looked at Ravitch apprehensively. He examined her thoroughly.
"But it is nothing, Doctor. You know how careful I am."
Ravitch did not reply. The girl continued to talk, hesitated, and began again. Ravitch swabbed a second time and examined it.
"You are sick, Martha," he said.
"What?" She jumped up. "That can't be true."
"It is true."
She looked at him. Then she broke out suddenly, a flood of curses and maledictions.
"That swine, that damned swine, I didn't trust him anyway, the slippery trickster. He said he was a student and he ought to know, a medical student, that scoundrel."
"Why didn't you take care?"
"I did, but he went so quickly, and he said that he, as a student..."
Ravitch nodded. The old story. A medical student who had treated himself. After 2 weeks he had considered himself cured without making a test.
"How long will it take, Doctor?"
6 weeks.
Ravitch knew it would take longer.
6 weeks? 6 weeks without any income? Hospital? Do I have to go to the hospital?"
"We'll see about that. Maybe we can treat you at home later, if you promise."
"I'll promise anything. Anything. Only not the hospital."
"You've got to go at first. There's no other way."
The girl stared at Ravitch. All prostitutes feared the hospital. The supervision was very strict there. But there was nothing else to do. Left at home, she would furtively go out after a few days, in spite of all the promises, and look for men in order to make money and infect them.
"The madame will pay the expenses," Ravitch said.
"But I... 6 weeks without any income, and I've just bought a silver fox on instalments. Then the instalment will be due and everything will be gone,"
she cried. "Come, Martha," Roland said.
"You won't take me back, I know."
Martha sobbed louder.
"You won't take me back, you never do. Then I'll be on the streets, and all because of that slippery dog."
"We'll take you back. You were good business. Our clients like you."
"Really?"
Martha looked up.
"Of course.
And now come." Martha left with Roland. Ravitch looked after her. Martha would not come back. Madame was much too careful. Her next stage was perhaps the cheap brothels in the Rue Blondel, then the street, then cocaine, the hospital, peddling flowers or cigarettes, or, if she were lucky, some pimp who would beat and exploit her and later throw her out. The dining room of the Hôtel International was in the basement. The lodgers called it the catacombs. During the day a dim light came through several large, thick, opalescent glass panes which faced on the courtyard. In the winter it had to be lighted all day long. The room was at once a writing room, a smoking room, an auditorium, an assembly room, and a refuge for those emigrants who had no papers. When there was a police inspection, they could escape through the yard into a garage and from there to the next street. Ravitch sat with the doorman of the Scheherazade nightclub, Boris Morozov, in a section of the catacombs that the landlady called the palm room. On a spindly-legged table, a solitary, miserable palm languished there in a majolica pot. Morozov was a refugee from the First War and had lived in Paris for the last 15 years. He was one of the few Russians who did not claim to have served in the Tsar's guard and who did not speak of his aristocratic family. They were sitting and playing chess. The catacombs were empty except for one table at which a few people were sitting and drinking and talking in loud voices, breaking into a toast every few minutes. Morozov looked around angrily.
"Can you explain to me, Ravitch, why there is such a rumpus here tonight? Why don't these refugees go to bed?"
Ravitch smiled. "The refugees in that corner don't concern me, Boris. That is the fascist section of the hotel. Spain."
"Spain? Weren't you there, too?"
"Yes, but on the other side. Moreover, as a doctor. These are Spanish monarchists with fascist trimmings. The remnants of them. The others have gone back a long time ago. These haven't quite been able to make up their minds yet. Franco was not Gentile enough for them. The Moors who butchered Spaniards naturally did not disturb them." Morozov placed his chessmen. "Then they probably are celebrating the massacre at Guernica, or the victory of Italian and German machine guns over the miners in Extremadura. Never before have I seen those fellows here." "They have been here for years. You didn't see them because you never eat here."
"Do you eat here?"
"No." Morozov grinned. "All right," he said. "Let's skip my next question and your answer, which certainly would be insulting. For all I care, they could have been born here in this hole. They would only lower their voices. Here, the good old Queen's Gambit." Ravitch moved the pawn opposite. They made the first moves quickly. Then Morozov began to brood.
"There is a variant by Alekhine."
Ravitch saw that one of the Spaniards was coming over. He was a man with close-set eyes, and he stopped by their table. Morozov looked at him ill-humouredly. The Spaniard did not stand quite straight.
"Gentlemen," he said politely, "Colonel Gomez requests you to drink a glass of wine with him."
"Sir,"
Morozov replied with equal politeness,
"we are just playing a game of chess for the championship of the 17th arrondissement. We express our grateful thanks, but we can't come."
The Spaniard did not move a muscle. He turned to Ravitch formally, as if he were at the court of Philip II. "You rendered a friendly service to Colonel Gomez some time ago. He would like to have a drink with you in token of appreciation before his departure."
"My partner," Ravitch replied with the same formality, "has just explained to you that we must play this game today. Give my thanks to Colonel Gomez. I am very sorry."
The Spaniard bowed and went back. Morozov chuckled. "Just like the Russians in the first years, stuck to their titles and manners as if they were life preservers. What friendly service did you render to this Hottentot?" "Once I prescribed a laxative for him. The Latin people have a high regard for good digestion." Morozov winked at Ravitch. "The old weakness of democracy. A fascist in the same situation would have prescribed arsenic for a democrat." The Spaniard returned.
My name is Navarro, first lieutenant,"
he declared with the heavy earnestness of a man who has drunk too much and does not know it.
"I am the aide-de-camp of Colonel Gomez. The colonel is leaving Paris tonight. He is going to Spain to join the glorious army of Generalissimo Franco. That's why he would like to drink with you to Spain's freedom and to Spain's army."
"Lieutenant Navarro," Ravitch said briefly, "I'm not a Spaniard."
"We know that. You are a German."
Navarro showed the shadow of a conspiratorial smile. "That's just the reason for Colonel Gomez's wish. Germany and Spain are friends." Ravitch looked at Morozov. The irony of the situation was marked. Morozov kept from smiling.
"Lieutenant Navarro," he said,
I regret that I must insist on finishing this game with Dr. Ravitch. The results must be cabled to New York and Calcutta tonight.
Sir, Navarro replied coldly, we expected you to decline. Russia is Spain's enemy. The invitation was directed to Dr. Ravitch only. We had to invite you, too, since you were with him.
Morozov placed the knight he had won on his huge, flat hand and looked at Ravitch.
Don't you think there has been enough of this buffoonery?
Yes.
Ravitch turned around.
I think the simplest thing is that you go back, young man. You have needlessly insulted Colonel Morozov, who is an enemy of the Soviets.
He bent over the chessboard without waiting for an answer. Navarro stood undecided for a moment. Then he left.
I don't know whether you noticed that I have just promoted you to the rank of colonel, Boris, Ravitch said. As far as I know, you are a miserable lieutenant colonel. But it seemed unbearable to me that you shouldn't have the same military rank as this Gomez.
Don't talk so much, old boy. I've just messed up Alekhine's variant because of these interruptions. That bishop seems to be lost.
Morozov looked up.
My God, here comes another one. Another aide-de-camp. What a people.
It is Colonel Gomez himself.
Ravitch leaned back comfortably.
This will be a discussion between two colonels.
Short one, my son.
The colonel was even more formal than Navarro. He apologized to Morozov because of his aide-de-camp's error. The apology was accepted. Now Gomez invited them to drink together to Franco as a sign of reconciliation, since all obstacles had been removed. This time Ravitch refused.
But, sir, as a German and an ally...
The colonel was obviously confused.
Colonel Gomez, said Ravitch, who was gradually becoming impatient, leave the situation as it is. Drink to whomever you like and I'll play chess.
The colonel tried to puzzle it out.
Then you are a...
You'd better make no statements,
Morozov interrupted him briefly. It would only lead to conflict. Gomez became more and more confused.
But you, as a white Russian and an officer of the Tsar, must be against...
We don't have to be anything at all. We are old-fashioned creatures. We have different political opinions and nevertheless don't break each other's skulls.
Finally it seemed to dawn upon Gomez. He stiffened.
I see, he declared sharply. Decadent, democratic, my friend, Morozov said, suddenly becoming dangerous. Get out. You should have got out years ago, to Spain, to fight. Germans and Italians fought for you there instead. Adieu.
He got up. Gomez took one step back. He stared at Morozov, disconcerted. Then he abruptly turned around and went back to his table. Morozov sat down again. He sighed and rang for the waitress.
Bring us two double Calvados, Clarice.
Clarice nodded and disappeared.
Stout soldierly souls, Ravitch laughed. A simple mind and a complicated conception of honour make life very difficult when one is drunk, Boris.
That I see. Here comes the next one already. Who is it this time? Franco himself?
It was Navarro. He stopped two steps away from the table and addressed Morozov.
Colonel Gomez regrets to be unable to present his challenge. He is leaving Paris tonight. Besides, his mission is too important to risk difficulties with the police.
He turned toward Ravitch.
Colonel Gomez still owes you the fee for a consultation.
He threw a folded 5-franc bill on the table and was about to turn away.
One moment, Morozov said.
Clarice was just then at his side with a tray. He took a glass of Calvados, briefly contemplated it, shook his head and put it back. Then he took one of the water glasses from the tray and negligently tossed it in Navarro's face.
"That's to sober you up," he declared calmly. "Remember in the future that one doesn't throw money. And now get away from here, you medieval idiot."
Navarro stood still in astonishment. He dried his face. The other Spaniards approached. There were four of them. Morozov got up slowly. He was more than a head taller than the Spaniards. Ravitch remained sitting.
He looked at Gomez. "Don't make yourself ridiculous, you comic opera characters," he said. "None of you is sober. Within a few minutes you'll be lying here with broken bones. Even if you were sober, you would stand no chance."
He got up, seized Navarro by the elbows, lifted him and put him down so near to Gomez that Gomez had to step aside.
"And now leave us alone. We did not ask you to annoy us."
He took the 5-franc bill from the table and put it on the tray.
"That's for you, Clarice. From these gentlemen here."
"The first time I ever got anything from them," Clarice declared. "Thanks."
Gomez said something in Spanish. The 5 turned around and went back to their table.
"It's a pity," Morozov said. "I'd have liked to beat up those fellows. Sorry that it can't be done because of you, you illegal foundling. Don't you sometimes regret that you can't do it?"
"Not with those. There are others I'd like to get hold of."
A few words in Spanish became audible from the table in the corner. The 5 rose. A threefold viva resounded. The glasses were set down, clinking. There was the sound of one breaking. Then the marshal group filed out of the room.
"I almost threw this good Calvados in his face."
Morozov took the glass and emptied it.
"And that's the sort that governs Europe now. Were we too such fools once?"
"Yes,"
Ravitch said. They played for an hour. Then Morozov looked up.
"Well, there is Charles," he said. "He seems to be looking for you."
The boy from the concierge's box was coming toward them. He held a little package in his hand.
"This was left for you," he said to Ravitch.
"For me?"
Ravitch examined the package. It was small and wrapped in white tissue paper tied with a string. There was no address on it.
"I'm not expecting any packages. It must be a mistake. Who brought it?"
"A woman, a lady,"
the boy stammered.
"A woman or a lady?" Morozov asked.
"Or just in between."
Morozov grinned.
"Pretty sharp."
"There's no name on it. Did she say it was for me?"
"Not just like that. Not your name. She said it was for the doctor who lives here, and you know the lady."
"Did she say that?"
"No," the boy blurted. "But the other night she was with you."
"From time to time ladies do come in with me," Ravitch said. "But you should know that the first virtue of a hotel employee is discretion. Indiscretion is only for cavaliers of the great world."
"Go ahead and open the package, Ravitch," Morozov said, "even if it isn't for you. We've done worse in our deplorable lives."
Ravitch laughed and opened it. He unwrapped a small object. It was the wooden Madonna he had seen in the room of the woman. He tried to remember, what was her name? He had forgotten it. A name something like that. He examined the tissue paper. There was no slip in it.
"All right," he said to the boy. "It's for me."
He placed the Madonna on the table. It looked strange among the chessmen.
"A Russian?" Morozov asked.
"No.
I thought so, too, at first."
Ravitch noticed that the red of the lipstick had been washed off.
"What on earth shall I do with it?"
"Well, put it anywhere. Many things can be put just anywhere. There's plenty of room for everything in this world. Only not for human beings."
"They will have buried the man, meanwhile."
"Is she the one?"
"Yes."
"Did you ever bother to see her again?"
"No."
"Strange," Morozov said. "We always think we've helped, and yet we stop just when it's hardest for the other."
"I'm no charitable institution, Boris, but I have seen worse than that and done nothing.
Why should it be harder for her now?"
"Because now she's alone. Up to now the man was there even though he was dead. He was above the earth. Now he's below it. Gone. Not here any more. This," Morozov pointed at the Madonna, "is not thanks. It is a cry for help."
"I slept with her, without knowing what had happened. I want to forget that."
"Nonsense. It is the least important thing in the world as long as there is no love in it. I knew a woman who said it was easier to sleep with a man than to call him by his first name."
Morozov leaned forward. His large, bald head reflected the light.
"I will tell you something, Ravitch.
We ought to be friendly to people if we can, and as long as we possibly can, because we're still going to commit a few so-called crimes in our lives. At least I will, and probably you too.
Yes. Morozov put his arm around the pot containing the meagre palm. It trembled slightly.
We all feed on one another. Such occasional little sparks of kindliness, that's something one shouldn't allow to be taken away. It strengthens one for a difficult life.
All right. I'll go to see her tomorrow.
Fine, Morozov said. That's what I meant. And now stop talking so much. Who has white?